The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In thinking about today, I found myself much more interested in you than me. So I'm curious what kind of, I'd like to hear from you, what your concerns are in relationship to meditation or Buddhism, and what kind of questions you might have. I know it's a bit sudden, but but good Buddhists are supposed to be ever ready with questions.
My ever concern is continuing my practice. So is you know, the perpetuation or continuation of sitting daily and you know, the energy that that takes, or uh-huh, dedication, commitment. Okay.
It's a great thing to be concerned about. Is there a question about it?
How do you do it?
Or how to do it. So what's the issue, though? Is there a problem with doing it?
No. Finding time. Making the effort, I guess.
So there's the problem of time, which is a problem for many people. And then the other problem, even if there was time, it requires some effort. And so if you had all the time in the world, you'd still have to, the hurdle of... And what gets in the way of the effort? Are you lazy?
Partly.
Partly?
And, you know, I'm busy as well.
You're busy, so...
I'm lazy and busy.
Lazy and busy. Do those two go together?
Yeah, isn't this about duality? Yeah. No.
For some lazy people, being busy is the easy thing to do.
Yeah, indeed.
Because it means you don't have to look at yourself. So it's a great concern, and I'm sure that what you brought up is shared by many people in this life here. It's hard, I think, in a lay life where there's not a lot of structure to have a regular practice and practice ongoingly. I mean, I was lucky in my 20s when I started getting serious about practice. First I was in college, and somehow the life of college for me, at least, allowed me to structure my life so I would meditate twice a day. And then after that I went and lived at a Zen center, and where structure was offered me. But for people who are on their own, there are coming here helps some people, coming to a meditation center on a regular basis. It kind of gives a little bit of structure in the week, and gives a little bit more momentum to sit with people. And feel that encouragement sometimes makes it easier then to kind of keep it going during the week. But still, you know, if people go home and there's no, you know, if you live alone, or if you live with someone who doesn't care about what your practice is, in fact, sometimes it's even they'd rather you didn't do it, because, you know, it takes you away from them and kind of changes the routine of the house somehow. And so it can be hard to keep it going. So one of the things I think does help is having a routine, setting up your own routine. And so some people's lives allow for routine if they have a regular work job and they go to job work at a certain time. And then figure out when in the course of the regular day it makes sense to have the routine, the schedule, where that's where you're going to meditate. And some psyches work a lot better on a routine. Just, this is what you do, and after a while you get used to it. You know, this is what I do. There's no question about it. I do this regardless of what. And then closely connected to that is the issue of priorities. And to really do an honest assessment of what's really important for you and your priorities, and then what does it take to stand behind them? I know for some people it's really easy for highest priority to be relief and comfort. And so, you know, television, or nowadays computers a lot, can offer the kind of distractions and relief and kind of certain kind of pleasure that people get lost in for a long time. But if they look at their life in the bigger picture, you know, it doesn't really do them much good, the amount of time they sit in front of a screen. And their time is much better spent meditating, or talking with a friend, or going for a walk, or many things which are much better for you than some of the endless pursuits that some people take. And so sometimes it's looking at our priorities, and really, some people find it really helpful to really kind of sit down with a piece of paper and really look over the course of the week what your time is actually spent doing. And I know some people are surprised when they actually do the exercise to see, well, wow. You know, I spent endless amount of time doing X, Y, and Z. I had no idea it was that much. I kind of had fooled myself into believing I didn't do it so much. And so that can, you know, look at your priorities. And then to get serious about priorities. I don't think that it's hard to get involved in any spiritual practice unless there's a strong intention for it. And so how do you strengthen that muscle of intention? And one of the ways that I've strengthened it is by repeatedly asking myself the question, what is my intention? What is my deepest intention? That's such an important question that I think that more valuable than meditating every day, which I think is valuable, is asking the question every day, what is your deepest intention? Because if you really check in with that, you might be surprised, you know, it might morph and change over time, what's most important for you. But also, many people don't ask themselves that question. What's the deepest intention? What is the most important thing I want in my life? When I come to my end of my life and look back and want to see what my life was about, is it more computer time? You know, that was, you know, I'm so glad. Or is it, you know, what do you want your life to be about? I think those are really important questions, and to ask those regularly and be reminded regularly about what's most important for you, and then say, well, and then try to organize your life to be behind it. And if it happens that your deepest intention has no connection at all to meditation, then maybe you should, you know, chuck the meditation part. You know, maybe it's not important enough for you. Some people try to think it's a really good idea to meditate or do kind of spiritual practice, but it's not really connected to where their heart is. It's more like a should. You know, they've learned from their somehow, somewhere, that they should be spiritual, they should go to a church, they should do something. And so they try really hard because they're supposed to, but it's not really where their heart is. And that's not very useful then. So I trust the heart more than any shoulds. So I think the regular reflection about the deepest intention is also interesting because it changes over time. And if you hang out for a while and you have some obvious answer, and then you keep asking, and you say, oh, behind that there might be another answer. A very interesting thing to do if you ask, if you explore what your deepest intention is, if your deepest intention is stated negatively, for example, to live without fear, or to live without being afraid of anything, so for some people that's a profound wish because they live in so much fear, but it's stated negatively, to be without something. If you find your deepest intention is stated negatively, then turn it around and try to say it positively. Or if you could have that, then what would you, if you could be without fear, then what would your deepest intention be? And see if you can come with a positive statement rather than a negative one. Sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes being accountable to someone helps with the discipline of practice. So if you have a friend, like you, maybe some you practice together with, and say, you know, let's check in regularly, make sure. I'll tell you if I don't do it. You know, I'll tell you if I do it. Somehow, very, you know, someone's not going to be, you know, judgmental or, you know, but someone you talk to, and so you can back your mind some sense. Oh yeah, you know, this is important. I've told my friend I'm going to do it, and my friend's going to ask me, and that's the arrangement we have. Can give some strength to it. For some people, one of the really, really useful things to do is to have really good sleep patterns. And I know some people have this, you know, will easily kind of stay up later and later and later, and then they're too tired to get up in the morning to meditate. So there has to be some discipline. And that's, the discipline of meditation might not be difficult if they can be disciplined by going to sleep in a good time. It might be easier to get up early. So anyway, those are some things that occur to me. Maybe the mic over here.
Oh. Hi. Can you hear me? I just realized as you were saying that one of my little habits or superstitions or something that I have is actually might be thought of as a way of routinizing stating to oneself one's deepest intention. Uh-huh. And this is what I do. Uh-huh. Whenever I go over a railroad track, I make a wish. And it has evolved to become, I wish for the deepest thing that is important to me. And I never thought of it this way, but it's connecting with my deepest intention mm-hmm. every time I go over a railroad track.
Is it stated in the abstract, or you have something particular you have in mind?
It's very concrete. Like, lately I've been thinking about avoiding perseveration. You know, kind of reining in the unconscious internal rant.
Uh-huh. Beautiful. Beautiful. And if you could do that, then what?
Then you move on to another intention. I mean, the point is, if you think about your deepest intention and by force of habit every time you go over a railroad track or something else, it keeps your deepest intention closer to the surface more frequently.
Exactly.
In the day.
It's beautiful. I hope you go across a lot of railroad tracks.
In Menlo Park, you do.
Get here.
My question is about if you have suggestions to help with the practice of detachment.
Help with the practice of detachment. So it's probably a wonderful question. I don't want to take away from the question, but in Buddhist English, we very seldom use the word detachment. We use the word non-attachment. And there's a difference between us in Buddhist English. And non-attachment is the healthy form of not clinging. Detachment, in our Buddhist English, at least some of us, is a kind of unhealthy kind of aloofness or distancing from experience. So I'm sure you meant the first type, non-attachment. But I think it's an important distinction. I mean, maybe you don't. Many people don't use Buddhist English this way, but the distinction is still valid, important. That not all detachment or non-attachment is healthy. But letting go of all clinging is. So again, the question is, how do you?
Do you have suggestions to help with non-attachment, with the practice of non-attachment?
One of the best things to do is to study your attachment. Become that, you know, rather than getting unattached quickly, spend time to really get to know your attachments well, and sit with them, explore them, journal about them, talk to friends about them, do whatever you can. Really, really, because sometimes if you understand something really well, it'll let go of itself. But if you try too hard, too quickly to let go of something, then it just comes back and grabs on again and again. So I would wait with attachment and spend time looking at it and understanding it. And there's so many different things to be aware of when you're attached, when you're clinging. There's your beliefs around the thing you're attached to. There's the beliefs you have about yourself in relationship to the thing you're clinging to. There's the emotions that are connected to the whole phenomenon of attachment. There are the physical and mental sensations in your body. There can be contraction and tightness or energy or revving up. There's a whole slew of things that you can kind of explore. And as you get into it and be present, in the present moment, really feel it and be present for it. It's interesting what happens. And one of the best places to study attachment is in meditation. So you might look for really good attachment that you have, and when it comes up really strongly for you, go find a quiet place and sit down and just sit, meditate with it, and see what happens if you're really present for it. So that's one of the things I would recommend. One of the first things that come to mind. And then the other thing that's connected to that is to ask yourself, what stands in the way? What gets in the way of you releasing the attachment? So, there's some secondary thing that gets in the way, and sometimes there is the secondary thing, and a very common one is fear. So then it becomes a whole study of your relationship to fear and what's going on with fear, and sometimes with fear it's good to study it really well, and just like with the attachment, and sometimes it's good to take some risks. See what happens. Does this speak to you, or yeah? Okay, let's leave it at that then. It's here.
What if the attachment is something that you think is your deepest intention, like to your spouse? for instance.
What about it?
If your feeling of your greatest attachment is love, to have a very deep connection with someone.
Yeah.
And that's something you don't want to release, you know, but it is an attachment.
Yeah, then you'll suffer.
Yeah.
It's your choice.
What do you do?
I think one of the most beautiful things that can come from something like a spiritual discipline, I hope, or certainly Buddhist practice, is to be able to separate out the attachment to someone we love from the love itself. Because attachment and love are two different things. Though some people don't see them as different. There are some people that are so intertwined that it's inconceivable they'd be separate. And if they're inconceivable to be separate from each other, then giving up attachment would seem like giving up the love. And in fact, I think a lot of relationships, that's 90% of it, is that some form of attachment. And sometimes people don't really love the person, they love the attachment. You know, the connection, what's important. And so one of the really beautiful things that can happen when we really pay attention to attachment and to love and to practice is that those get separated out, and then the love can exist independent of the attachment. And then sometimes it takes a lot of trust, or developing a lot of trust, that it's okay to be in a relationship, a deep, intimate relationship with love, but without holding on to it. You know, if I don't hold on, if I don't do the things that, make it to hold on, then the person's going to drift off or not love me or something. And and to have the trust, it's okay just to love. And it helps to know that there's an important distinction between attachment and commitment. And it's okay, there can be very powerful commitment without there being attachment. And so if the commitment's there, sometimes that can hold the love. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, thank you.
It's really one of the really beautiful things, important things to do in life is to separate out love from attachment. It's in the back, if you can pass it to the outer hall.
I was at the end of life conference yesterday, and it was all about your end of life, and next week, Saturday, is going to be all about end of life of another person. I would like to just hear your take on how to help a person who's going through end of life from the Buddhist perspective, because myself, I was raised Christian, so it's like a whole different thing. I'd just like to hear your perspective of how you would help someone or comfort someone or share what you know, because it seems so much like Buddhism is all about making your life today better by being on it, non-attached and being, present and being this and being that. How would you help a person going through end of life who may or may not be familiar with Buddhism?
Yeah, that was an important issue, was, who you're talking to. But, one of the things I do is train people to be chaplains, hospital chaplains, and they go around. And there in the hospital, you might run into people of any religion or non-religion who is dying. And so how does a chaplain meet such a person? I think the first thing is to offer your attention, your presence. Just to be with someone is quite powerful. And some people don't have that very much. So someone high quality, so someone really be present and not trying to fix them or change them or talk fast to avoid what's going on or even being excessively sympathetic. Oh, poor you! Is a headache sometimes if you get too much of that. But someone who's willing to just be with you as a human being, as if you're not dying, perhaps even just willing to come with an open mind, beginner's mind, just kind of be there, is one of the really powerful things. But I mean, that's 90% of it, is just to offer presence, and then show an interest in the person. Show an interest in the person, not what you're interested in, but rather, in the person, but rather, how much taxes do you pay? And someone's dying, you say, what was your salary like? I mean, I'm interested. I mean, that's not real interest. More like interest, you're interested in what that person's interested in. You're interested in what's important for that person. And so you can ask very simple, non-threatening questions you're not trying to, you're kind of opening the door for them, saying, I'm interested in you. What's important for you? What would you like to share? sometimes it's not even a question, sometimes a very simple statement can open the door for someone. You know, like it's, you could sometimes saying something like, you know, it must be hard to be here. And that simple question, it must be hard, that statement. For some people, you know, I've been in situations where all the family members were denying the person was terribly sick. And, oh, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. And then as soon as someone said, it must be hard, it was like, oh, finally I've been seen. Finally someone understands what it's like for me. And they could relax because they were seen or recognized rather than always. So very simple statements that are not, don't probe or go too far to see if what the person would like, what they're interested in. And sometimes what people want, you'd be surprised what people want as they're dying. It can be all kinds of things. Maybe they want a coffee milkshake, and you know, and no one's offered them, you know. Or it could be that they want, I was surprised once to visit someone who was dying, close to death. And mostly what was going on was the person was really angry at the number of family people. And I was kind of surprised. I thought, but then I found out that was from my first encounters with someone who's dying, and since then I learned it's quite common for people to be angry, very angry. And sometimes people who are dying at some phase of their death will lash out at the people they're closest to. So then it's important to know that pattern, so you don't take it personally and say, oh, this is part of their process, where it's, I don't know, maybe it's the chemicals in the brain, or who knows what's going on. So it's, as you're doing and staying with a person, you're very gently kind of assessing, what does a person need? And is it what the person needs? What's appropriate for you as a caregiver? As a, you know, so if it's your sibling, maybe you can do a lot for them, or maybe you better do almost nothing, depending on the family history, what's been going on. If you're there sometimes at IMC, if someone's dying, we'll do vigils where people at IMC will come and take turns just sitting with someone. And mostly you just sit there and have a very simple presence. But the person, you know, a lot of people here are not trained to offer spiritual care, so you better not try doing too much. So you want to keep it really, really simple. You might assess, oh, this person needs a chaplain, like they're dying in the hospital. So maybe you call the local chaplain to come and see, or a local minister to come. This person needs it to really get some real spiritual attention. And sometimes just sitting there, you might be surprised that the person opens up in some of their deepest secrets and will start pouring forth. And your job is to just be the witness for it and to allow that to happen. And other times, someone's dying, and the most important thing you can do for them is to sit with them watching Jeopardy on TV. You know, somehow they just want to watch the television show. And someone I know died earlier last year, and I was told by the caretaker who was with her that the last thing she wanted to do before she died was to play, I think it was bridge. I think it was like some card game, so it was bridge, and that's what she most wanted to do, so her friends played bridge with her. And sometimes people involved with spiritual care think it has to be deeply spiritual, you know, but, you know, Jeopardy. You know, who knows? It's hard to know what people's processes, what's important for people. And you have to be very respectful and listen carefully what they need. Some people, it's kind of a little unusual, but some people like to die alone, and you create those situations. Sometimes people who are dying need to finish some unfinished business in their life before they can die. And so, if you're a caretaker and you get that indication, maybe there's ways of facilitating that. You know, like calling an aunt, saying, you know, so-and-so is dying, and she really wants us to talk to you before you die. Or a child, you know, could you come or have a conversation or something. So it's a whole topic. It's a big topic. And I guess they'll talk about next week. So I don't want to take their thunder. Yeah, so here, Nick.
Okay, getting back to the difference between love and attachment. I was talking to a friend recently, and he was scandalized that the Buddha, you know, we're talking about Buddhism, and the Buddha had deserted his family, his wife and his son, to go off and teach. And I was wondering, from the Buddhist perspective, how to put forth what that difference was. I mean, obviously, they were very wealthy. It wasn't like they were out destitute beggars or whatever without their father, but if you could discuss that, like the family life of the Buddha, that he would leave his wife and his son and for the life of a monastic.
So the question is about that, the Buddha. It's really hard for us, you know, nowadays in the United States, there's a fair amount now, at least in certain circles, appreciation of diversity issues. You know, people come from different cultures, different ethnic backgrounds, all kinds of different societies. And it's really hard, very, very important not to impose our particular values, our particular view of how things are onto other cultures. Certain kind of imperialism that goes on. And so, and a lot of that's gone on from the West, America, kind of imposing its values on other countries around the world. And just in the modern world, it's understood how difficult it is to, how important it is to be sensitive to these issues. And even things that we in the West, some of us in the West, think are cherished ideas like human rights, represent a certain way of structuring understanding human society and human life that other cultures don't share. They have another kind of perspective for understanding similar things. So, so now we're talking about not only a culture which is in a different part of the world, India, but we're talking about 2,500 years ago. And it's very hard for us to put ourselves to use modern American standards of a nuclear family and ideas of welfare, mom, and you know the father leaving the family, and to understand what family is and what relationships are. And it's really hard to impose that or apply that to some ancient world where it's hard to understand. I mean, I remember many years ago I went to the Amazon basin in a country called French Guiana. And I was on the border between French Guiana and Suriname. I think it was the Suriname River. And far upriver, a place where people seldom went. And we were in a village. And the village was of these people called the Boni, a tribe called the Boni, who were, I guess, African Americans who had been taken in, I don't know, 1600s or something, enslaved and captured in Africa and brought to by the Dutch, I think, to Suriname to be slaves. And in the first generation of being there, they'd escaped and lived in the jungles and had set up their tribal life and were living very much, in some ways, more tribal than culture than you could find in Africa, because they preserved, like the Appalachian Mountains, they preserved music better than they did in England because it was kind of isolated. So there were the Boni, and we went to one of the villages, and there were mostly women and children in the village. There were some men, and the women were really powerful people, beautiful women. And they explained, the women, very happily, this was a great arrangement for them, that they lived on the east side of the river in French Guiana, and the men were kind of banished. To the west side, and they were allowed to come visit occasionally. And it seemed to be, I don't know who started this arrangement, but the women seemed very happy with this arrangement. So what was going on? So this is modern world, right? This is nowadays, so that you find that, So what was going on back then? The Buddha leaving his family. It's really hard to look to kind of try to separate out our modern ideas of what this means from back then. But even here in the modern world, you find people, men and women as well, who sometimes feel so compelled by some need or some drive that they will, in a sense, leave their family for some time, and we don't necessarily feel so bad about it. It's like wow. Like recently, maybe you do, I don't know, you hear the stories. I read, I think it was in the Airline magazine, and when I went to Boston, and there was an article about this Frenchman who had decided to walk around the whole world. And he'd spent years and years doing it. He had to start over again. Not over again, but he had to kind of take a break and earn some money, and then he'd start again, and where he left off, and he'd walked all the way from South America all the way up, and he had somehow figured out how to get across the Bering Straits, And then he was put in jail in Russia for a while, and before they let him walk through Russia. But years and years and years. And he had a little boy, a son who he never knew as the son grew up. So it's kind of, you know, it's kind of painful, probably painful for the son. But, you know, I don't know what drove this man to do it, to do that. Or people who feel so driven to discover some scientific thing, and they just kind of pour themselves into their work because they have to. Or there are people who are in so much psychological pain that that they have no choice but to somehow deal with their pain. Or people who feel so motivated about issues of justice in the world that taking care of, you know, fighting injustice in the world becomes more important than really caring for their family in some way, or they staying there for it. And there's a lot of great political figure. You know, Mahatma Gandhi was supposed to have had a bad relationship with some of his kids. You know, he was the father of India in some ways, but his son was an alcoholic. And you know, so what was going on there? The and we have in the United States, we have now hundreds of thousands of men and women who have chosen to be in the military and leave their kids behind. And, you know, no one says, you know, how could you leave your kids behind and go spend, you know, several tours of duty in Iraq? But, you know, rather we feel proud of them, and you know, these people are defending the country or doing good work. But then we have these kids left behind. So here we have the Buddha. We don't know what was going on for him. His mother died when he was seven days old. And so, you know, it's possible he had some deep pain and suffering that we don't know what it's about. He might not have, psychologically, he might not have had any choice given the degree of pain that he's... You have to be really motivated to do what he did. And so what motivated was just like he, you know, woke up one day and thought it was a good idea. You know, he felt, you know, he might not have had a choice. He had to do something. He had to figure out something. And there weren't that many options back then in ancient India. Like he couldn't just go down to IMC and... You know, if IMC had been there, probably it would have been fine. He could have, you know, he would have stayed home then. And but you know, there was nothing. There was really nowhere to go, and no retreat centers, and so it required, you know, in order to really deal with a certain part of his psyche, his psychology, or his suffering, it required something different than what was possible in other ways. Maybe he had no choice. Psychologically, we know that some people don't have that. If you look at the consequence of it, of what he did, he set forth on one of the great explorations of humankind, where and he was able to, through his diligence and insight and work, discover aspects of human psychology that have been unparalleled and has been a tremendous offering to the world ever since. Now, does that justify leaving his son, his family? You know, we have a lot of people in our society who've done similar things and they don't get criticized so much. So, you know, it's hard to know what was going on. And I tend to give people who suffer a lot before they get enlightened a lot of leeway, a lot of kind of, I tend to kind of be very respectful of the, of how difficult human life is and what people are trying to cope with and deal with. And people, even if the Buddha had made a bad choice, He was not enlightened yet. It's been pointed out that if you go to Buddhist centers, probably not IMC, you know, none of you, of course, but you've come to Buddhist communities, and you find a very high percentage of people with more suffering you find in the ordinary population, more struggles, and these are people, because this is a place where people can come to get help, and so the Buddha needed help, and. You know, he was not enlightened yet. He was not a wise person yet. He was a struggling person. And so I kind of, you know, so who knows what was going on for him. After he was enlightened, he became the primary parent for his son. So it wasn't like he just left once and for all. You know, we don't have a lot of stories about how much he, you know, I parented his son, but we know that his son, from the time his son was about seven to the time his son was, you know, grown up, he was under the care of his father. We don't know what happened to the wife too much.
She became a nun. Yeah.
I don't think the wife became a nun. I don't know any stories. Maybe. It's possible. Everybody becomes nuns and monks in these fairy tales. But I don't know about her. His mother became a nun. Mahapajapati. That's his foster mother. And so that statue we have in the outer hall of Mahapajapati, that's the Buddha's foster mother and aunt.
In the full moon gathering group, I guess we've had some nuns and so forth come and speak, and they said that
His stepmother, yes. His stepmother, but I don't know about his wife. His wife, too? His wife.
I'm sorry, no, his wife became a nun as well. Uh-huh. Both of them.
Yeah, so I don't know what that was like for her, but to have the door open to really deep spiritual freedom, deep liberation of the heart, if that's what his wife was able to experience, it was probably worth for her the pain of him leaving the home. Yes.
My question is about faith and maybe interpretation. I'm wondering how to be faithful without being giving my authority away. And it seems to me as a teacher, sometimes I sit here and be like, I want that faith. You know, like
faith that I have.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, it really strikes me, but at the same time this question comes up, like, you know, I have like friends who they are really into astrology or Enneagram, and they can explain the whole world, everything that happens according to that. And sometimes I'm like, it seems like the same thing could be true of the Four Noble Truths or the Suttas, and that there's an extraordinary, like the suttas are so vague in a way and permissive, but yet at the same time you can always wring out this, you know, this dharma out of it. So I guess my question is kind of what is it about the Four Noble Truths that where we can find the truth, or we can find a way to have our own authority in it. I don't know. Do you kind of know what I mean?
I think it's a good one. The Four Noble Truths. So the question is, how can we have faith or confidence in the Four Noble Truths as a valuable approach to life or framework to look at our life or live our life by? And without interpreting or overlaying an interpretation, overlaying kind of belief system on top of it. I think the way to do it is to begin applying the Four Noble Truths, or applying it means to look at particular situations in your life and see it through the vantage point of the Four Noble Truths and see how useful they are. And so for example, if you are... next time you feel some mild suffering, some mild irritation, annoyance, or impatience or something, look at it from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths and say, well, here's the suffering, it's the first one, and then here's and look and see, what's the cause for this? What am I attached to? What am I clinging to? And if you can find that, then perhaps you can go to the Third Noble Truth and say, can I let go of that? Or can I at least intuit a possibility of letting go of it? But maybe hopefully if something's mild enough that you can let go of it. And then letting go of it, you see that you feel better. To have that practical experience with the Four Noble Truths is what can give you confidence. Oh, it works. It worked in that situation. And so then you can try it in a little more difficult situation. And after a while, you begin seeing that it actually works in many situations. And that's what gives you confidence, is the practical application of it, not the theory of it. To just have faith in the theory doesn't not going to do you any good anyway. So, but just your application of it, and I think what can elicit some deep faith or inspiration, something like religious faith in relationship to Four Noble Truths, is when we have a sense, or a clear understanding or sense, that it really applies to all suffering that we experience. And that it's a direct way of really getting into understanding or dealing with all suffering you possibly experience without having to have a typology that overlays all kinds of interpretations, understanding, classifications on top of our experience. So it's a way of actually freeing ourselves, looking more directly at the direct experience rather than seeing things through an interpretation. So it's raining today, right? So someone can tell you that having an umbrella is a good idea, and you go, well, I don't know if I'm going to believe that, and you know, have faith in that. I mean, that, what good is that? Or you could just take an umbrella with you and out and see that it works. So the Four Noble Truths are kind of like meant to be tried out, and in the trying them, you develop your confidence. That makes some sense, and when you either intuit or actually have an experience of how deep you can go into the heart, the Four Noble Truths, to liberate something profound, I think that's when people's kind of religious faith or inspiration gets quite strong around it. Okay, well, that was nice for me. Thank you I didn't want to have to listen to myself for today so much, as much as I usually do, but I wanted to hear from you and your concerns and interests, and so that was nice to hear that, and I appreciate it. Thank you for those who spoke up. When Marilyn, when you started your question about faith and authority, how do you negotiate your way through that? One of the ways to have healthy faith and not succumb to authority or in unhealthy ways is to always be ready to ask questions and ask a lot of questions and be ever ready with questions. I think a Buddhist path of practice unfolds a lot better if you're kind of inclined to be questioning all the time. Well, how's this work? What's going on? And questioning teachers, Buddhist teachers, is a really good thing to do. And if they're not willing to take the questions, then find another Buddhist teacher. Okay, so I mean, at the right time for the questions, please. So thank you very much. Those of you who are new today, if you'd like to stay for the potluck, if you don't. You might just look around you and see if there's a lot of people probably right near you who have been here for a long time. If you want to say hello and be introduced, please just kind of turn to someone and introduce yourself so that you feel a little connected. Thank you.